All right, let's jump into a deep dive, shall we? This time, we're tackling the geography of Palestine during the time of Jesus.
A fascinating topic.
It really is. And to guide our exploration, we're turning to Dr. Robert C. Newman's Synoptic Gospels, Lecture 10, Geography of Palestine.
Excellent choice.
What struck me is how understanding the physical layout of the land really sheds light on, the events in the Gospels.
Oh, absolutely. It's like having a mental map, you know? Helps you grasp the distances Jesus traveled, the challenges he faced, even the symbolism woven into his teachings.
Precisely. Newman kicks things off by taking us on a westward journey across the major regions of ancient Palestine.
Oh, interesting.
It's almost as if we're retracing the path of the wind and rain. Those elements played a huge role in shaping the land and its people.
Makes sense. So where do we begin on this westward track?
Well, our first stop is the coastal plain, that flat, fertile stretch along the Mediterranean.
Ah, yes, the coastal plain. Easy to see why it became a major route for both trade and, unfortunately, armies.
Right. You can practically picture those Roman legions marching up from Egypt or down from the north.
Can't forget about the impact of that vulnerability. Constant threat of invasion. Probably shaped their culture, made them more, shall we say, on edge.
That's a great point. Always prepared for conflict. And as we move a bit inland, we encounter the Shephelah, a region of low, rolling hills. Newman describes it as having those fertile valleys, perfect for travel and agriculture.
Ah, those valleys. Natural corridors connecting the coast to the mountains further in.
Exactly. I imagine those routes facilitated the exchange of everything, ideas, goods, even religious beliefs.
Oh, undoubtedly. And then we reach the heart of it all, the central hill country.
Now, this is where things get rugged. Sharp hills, V-shaped valleys. No wonder it was more defensible.
Oh, definitely. More defensible, but not without its challenges, especially for farming.
Imagine the ingenuity required to cultivate crops on those steep slopes, terraces, innovative techniques. These people were hardy, resourceful.
They had to be. And speaking of adaptation, there's that rain shadow effect Newman mentions. The west side of the hill country gets drenched while the east is much drier. It's like, the rain shadow east of the Rocky Mountains here in the U.S.
It's amazing how that one phenomenon impacts so much. The West, with its abundance of water, was likely more populated, more prosperous.
And the east, with less water, would be more sparsely populated. Different survival strategies, reliance on herding, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And as we continue eastward, we hit the dramatic Rift Valley. It's a massive geological fault running north to south.
The Rift Valley. Now that's striking.
It really is. And it's home to the Sea of Galilee, 600 feet below sea level.
And let's not forget the Dead Sea, plunging even further, over 1,000 feet below sea level.
It's a stark contrast, isn't it? The Dead Sea, so salty you can float effortlessly, that's a result of intense evaporation in that arid climate.
And then you have the Sea of Galilee,
Okay.
a freshwater lake, a vital source of life.
Connected by the Jordan River, flowing right through the Rift Valley, like a ribbon of life through a pretty unforgiving landscape.
A beautiful image. And finally, our eastward journey takes us to the Transjordan Plateau, east of the Rift Valley, a region that gets a brief taste of rain before merging with the Syrian desert.
It's incredible the diversity packed into such a relatively small area.
It really is. From lush coastal plains to rugged mountains, fertile valleys to arid deserts. And that diversity, it's not just the land. It's reflected in the people, the cultures, the stories that emerge from this region.
It really sets the stage for a deeper dive, doesn't it? We've traversed this land west to east. Now I'm ready for round two, a north-to-south exploration of some standout features.
Lead the way. I'm eager to see what we uncover.
All right, so for this leg of our journey, we got to start with the big guy.
Oh, you mean
Mount Hermon.
Mount Hermon, of course.
Towering over 9,000 feet high, southernmost peak of the Anti-Lebanon Range. Newman says its snow-capped peak is visible all the way from Galilee.
Can you imagine that view? Breathtaking.
Seriously. And practically speaking, all that snow melt would have been a vital water source, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mount Hermon, it's like a natural water tower, feeding the Jordan River and those streams that flow down into the valleys, a true source of life.
And speaking of life-giving water, our next stop is Galilee, known for its abundance of rainfall, fertile soil. Newman actually calls it the best-watered area in Palestine.
Oh, yeah. Quite a contrast to those arid regions we were just exploring.
Right. Galilee is divided into Upper and Lower Galilee, each with its own unique character.
And right in the heart of it all, the beautiful Sea of Galilee.
So with all that water, Galilee must have been a pretty prosperous region.
Definitely contributed to its agricultural productivity. I mean, it's no coincidence that Galilee was famous for its fishing, farming, thriving villages.
Makes total sense. And just south of Galilee, we find the Jezreel Valley, also known as the Plain of Esdraelon. Newman highlights its strategic importance. It's an east-west corridor, a natural passageway connecting the coast to the Jordan Valley.
The Jezreel Valley. Think of it like a crossroads, where cultures clashed, armies collided.
It was a vital trade route, for sure.
Oh, yeah. But also a battleground. Throughout history, I mean, the city of Megiddo, you know, where we get the term Armageddon, it's right on the edge of this valley.
It's like this powerful link between geography and history. And speaking of geographical barriers, at the southern edge of the Jezreel Valley, Mount Carmel rises up, almost like a wall.
Mount Carmel, yeah. Controlled those important passes, influenced north-south travel, really shaped the movement of people and goods.
It's amazing to see how these natural features played such a crucial role in shaping the region. But now we're heading further south, leaving behind those fertile valleys, entering the wilderness of Judea.
Now the landscape becomes a lot more stark. Unforgiving.
It's a world apart from the lush greenery of Galilee. Newman compares it to the Badlands of South Dakota. Hilly, dry, almost no vegetation.
A place of extremes.
Definitely. And what about the Negev? Even further south, Newman describes it as having good soil but minimal rainfall. I mean, how do people even make a living in such a challenging environment?
Well, the Negev is a testament to human ingenuity, adaptability. The ancient inhabitants, they developed these sophisticated techniques for water conservation and agriculture. You know, they managed to cultivate crops in this arid landscape.
It's really remarkable what people can achieve when they have to. Okay, so we've scaled mountains, crossed valleys, trekked through deserts, but we can't forget about the bodies of water that define this land. Let's dive into those, shall we?
Let's do it.
All right, when you think of ancient Palestine, that vast blue expanse of the Mediterranean Sea has got to come to mind.
True. The sea was a constant presence for the people of this region. But unlike some of their neighbors, you know, the Israelites weren't known for being great seafarers.
Oh, interesting. So no vast naval empire like the Romans or the Greeks?
Not quite. They were more likely to be middlemen in trade, you know, facilitating the movement of goods between those seafaring cultures and the interior.
Makes sense. So moving inland to the Sea of Galilee, that freshwater lake fed by the Jordan River.
Beautiful spot.
It is. I always picture it as this tranquil setting. But Newman mentioned something surprising. Sudden, fierce storms.
Ah, yes. Those storms. They could whip up in an instant, catch even experienced fishermen off guard.
So those gospel stories about Jesus calming the storm, it wasn't just a gentle breeze he was dealing with.
Not at all. It was a demonstration of power over nature itself, the kind of thing that would make a huge impact on the people who witnessed it.
Absolutely. And the Jordan River. More than just river, isn't it?
The Jordan. It's a lifeline for the whole region. Flows from the slopes of Mount Hermon all the way down to the Dead Sea. Drops over 2,300 feet in just 100 miles.
That's an incredible elevation drop. And speaking of dramatic drops, we can't forget about the Dead Sea, that infamous body of water known for its extreme salinity.
Yes. The Dead Sea, the lowest point on Earth. So salty you can float effortlessly. Those salts and minerals have been mined for centuries.
But it's also a reminder of the power of evaporation, isn't it? That hot, arid climate.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've covered those defining geographical features. Mountains, valleys, rivers, seas. What about the human landscape? I mean, what was the political situation like in Palestine during Jesus' time?
Well, I think of it as this patchwork of territories. Each with its own ruler and this unique blend of cultures.
A complex and often volatile mix.
Definitely. Okay, let's break it down. First up, Judea.
Right, Judea. It encompassed the area around Jerusalem, including Samaria to the north, Idumea to the south. Judea itself was predominantly Jewish, but Samaria was largely Gentile.
So already you see those cultural and religious tensions woven into the fabric of the land.
Absolutely. And politically, Judea was under Roman rule.
Right.
Governed by a combination of local Herods and Roman procurators.
A recipe for unrest.
Yeah. Tensions simmering between the Jewish population and the Roman overlords.
Okay. Then there's Galilee, where Jesus spent a lot of his ministry. How did that region differ from Judea?
Well, Galilee, west of the Sea of Galilee, had a really interesting history. It was once largely Gentile. But the Hasmoneans, they repopulated it with Jews. So by Jesus' time, it was a predominantly Jewish region. But it had this reputation, you know, for being a bit more independent. a bit more rebellious, maybe.
So this potential contrast between the more urban, Roman-influenced Judea and the more rural, independent-minded Galilee.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
And on the eastern side of the Jordan River, we have Perea.
Perea, a narrower strip of land, was also predominantly Jewish, ruled by Herod Antipas, the same tetrarch who governed Galilee.
And if I remember correctly, there was another territory ruled by one of Herod the Great's sons, the Tetrarchy of Philip.
You're right, Philip's Tetrarchy, northeast of the Sea of Galilee, known for its stunning natural beauty and a diverse population. Jews and Gentiles living side by side.
A more peaceful region compared to the volatile Judea.
It seems that way, from the historical accounts.
Okay, and then there's the Decapolis. It just sounds so grand.
The Decapolis. Yeah, it was a league of 10 Hellenistic cities, mostly east of the Jordan.
Uh-huh.
But extending to the shores of the Sea of Galilee as well, think of them as independent city-states, each with its own surrounding territory, all bastions of Greek culture and trade.
So you have these bustling Greek cities dotted across a landscape dominated by Jewish and Roman influences. It's like this fascinating, complex cultural tapestry.
Absolutely. And it's something to keep in mind as we explore the cities themselves. It wasn't a monolithic culture. You had these different influences interacting, sometimes clashing.
Right. Well, when we talk about cities, we have to start with Jerusalem, the heart of Jewish religious and cultural life.
Jerusalem, a city steeped in history, strategically located on a ridge in the hill country, a natural fortress, was home to Herod's palace, later used by the Roman governor, and, of course, the magnificent temple, the center of Jewish worship.
And then there's Caesarea Maritima, that impressive Roman capital built by Herod the Great on the coast.
Caesarea Maritima, a marvel of engineering. Herod actually created an artificial harbor there, a real testament to his ambition and his desire to make a statement.
It was a bustling port city.
It was a symbol of Roman power and influence.
So you have Jerusalem, the heart of Jewish identity, and Caesarea Maritima, the symbol of Roman authority. And scattered throughout the land, you had all these other important towns and villages, each with its own story to tell.
Places like Sebaste, the ancient city of Samaria, rebuilt by Herod. Tiberias on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. Caesarea Philippi in Philip's Tetrarchy. And of course, those smaller towns. Nazareth, Cana, Capernaum, Jericho, Bethlehem, Emmaus. Places that hold so much significance.
It's amazing to think that Jesus walked those streets, interacted with those people, left his mark on those places. But how did people even get around? I mean, what were the major roads connecting this land?
Well, there were three main arteries, each with its own unique character. First, you have the Via Maris, the Way of the Sea, that coastal highway running from Egypt all the way up to Damascus and beyond.
I can picture those caravans of traders and travelers, you know, making their way along that ancient route.
Exchanging goods and stories from far-flung land.
Exactly. And then you have the King's Highway, running along the Transjordan Plateau, another vital route, linking south to north.
And finally, there's the Ridge Route. Maybe not as glamorous, but equally important. Running along the spine of the Central Hill Country.
And that was the route that Jewish pilgrims would have taken to travel between Jerusalem and Galilee, right?
That's the one. But it had its drawbacks. The ridge route, it passed through Samaria, often a source of tension and conflict between Jews and Samaritans.
No, right.
So pilgrims, they had to choose, take a faster route through potentially hostile territory or a longer, safer detour.
Tough choice. Before we move on to exploring Jerusalem in more detail, we have to talk about Herod the Great's, well, his obsession with fortifications. He was constantly building fortresses.
Herod, he was obsessed with security. Always wary of internal rebellions and the threat of invasion, particularly from the Parthians to the east. So he dotted the landscape with fortresses, turning strategic locations into these impenetrable strongholds.
Like Machaerus, east of the Dead Sea, where John the Baptist was executed.
Machaerus.
Yeah.
A grim reminder of Herod's ruthlessness. And then there's Masada, perched dramatically on a plateau overlooking the Dead Sea. It became the site of the Zealots' last stand against the Romans. A story of defiance, courage, and ultimately, tragedy.
And Herodium, that incredible hilltop fortress southeast of Bethlehem. Newman said Herod actually reshaped the hill to resemble a volcano.
It's true. A testament to his ambition and his ego. All right, let's shift our focus now to Jerusalem itself. What were some of the key geographical features that define this city?
Well, Jerusalem, it's a city of hills and valleys. And those features played a huge role in its history and development. Starting with the valleys, you have the Hinnom Valley running along the west side of the city.
The Hinnom Valley, it had some pretty dark connotations.
Yeah, like what?
Well, this is where the city's garbage was burned. and it became associated with Gehenna, a fiery underworld in Jewish tradition.
Wow, so geography intertwined with religious beliefs.
Exactly.
Okay, then there's the Kidron Valley, separating the city from the Mount of Olives to the east. That's where the Garden of Gethsemane was located, right?
That's right, a place of profound significance, where Jesus prayed and was arrested on the night before his crucifixion.
Right. And then there's the Tyropian Valley, which once divided the city into two distinct ridges. But it's largely filled in now.
It is.
So you have these valleys encircling the city, almost like moats. And rising up from those valleys, the hills, each with its own story to tell.
You have Ophel, the site of the original Jebusite city south of the Temple Mount. That's where Jerusalem's story began, centuries before the time of Jesus. And then, of course, there's Mount Moriah, the site of the temple, a place sacred to both Jews and Christians.
And what about Mount Zion? That's significant as well, right?
Mount Zion, yes. But the term Zion, it's a bit confusing because its meaning has shifted over time. Originally, it referred to either Ophel or Mount Moriah, but eventually became a more general term for Jerusalem itself. Today, it's often associated with the Western Hill, where the upper city was located.
So the meaning of Zion evolved. It became more symbolic than purely geographical. And finally, we have the Mount of Olives, overlooking the city from the east.
The Mount of Olives, a place of immense significance. It's where Jesus ascended to heaven, according to Christian tradition, and it offers that breathtaking panoramic view of Jerusalem, a view that Jesus himself would have seen.
Okay, so we've got these valleys and hills, and of course those iconic walls that define the city limits.
Walls of Jerusalem, yeah. Crucial for its defense. They followed the natural contours of the valleys. It was a formidable fortress.
But the north side was the most vulnerable, right? Since it lacked that natural barrier.
Exactly. And because of that, right, multiple walls were built on the north side as the city expanded. The first north wall ran from the Joppa Gate to the Temple Mount, and the second wall enclosed a larger area further north. But the third wall, the one that encloses an even larger area, it wasn't built until much later. So during Jesus' time, that area was essentially a suburb outside the city walls.
It's fascinating to see how the city evolved and adapted.
Yeah.
And within those walls, you had these distinct sections.
Right. You had the City of David, the original settlement, on Ophel. Then there was the Temple Mount on Mount Moriah, the lower city in the Tyropian Valley, the upper city on the higher ground to the west, and the second quarter in the new city, both expanding northward beyond those original city limits.
Okay, my mental map of Jerusalem is really coming together.
Yeah.
What about the major buildings and structures within the city? Let's start with the most impressive one, the temple complex.
The temple, yeah. It wasn't just a building. It was this massive platform, a raised plaza that dominated the city. Herod the Great significantly expanded this platform, created this monumental space that dwarfed the earlier temples. It was surrounded by courtyards, porticos, and of course the temple itself, located at the heart of it all.
It must have been an awe-inspiring sight.
It was. The platform was about 750 feet east-west and twice that north-south.
Wow.
And just north of the temple, you had another imposing structure, the Fortress Antonia.
Ah, yes. The Roman garrison, tasked with keeping order, especially during those religious festivals when tensions could run high.
Exactly. The Fortress Antonia overlooked the temple complex, allowed the Romans to keep a watchful eye on the crowds, intervene quickly if necessary.
It's a reminder of that Roman presence in Jerusalem and the potential for conflict.
For sure. Let's not forget about the Joppa Gate, the western entrance to the city, guarded by those three massive towers built by Herod.
I've seen pictures. Those towers are huge.
They are. And just south of the Joppa Gate, you had Herod's palace, a magnificent structure that later served as the residence of the Roman governor.
It's incredible to think about those structures, you know, standing for centuries, witnesses to history. And what about those sites specifically associated with Jesus's ministry? What stood out to you?
Well, there's the Pool of Bethesda, where Jesus healed the paralytic. Excavations have revealed a pool with five porticos, matching the description in the Gospel of John.
It's amazing how those biblical stories come to life through archaeology.
It really is. And then there's the Pool of Siloam, where Jesus sent a blind man to wash and regain his sight.
Powerful imagery, healing, transformation.
And then we have the Upper Room, traditionally believed to be the location of the Last Supper, although its authenticity is debated.
And Caiaphas's house, where Jesus was taken after his arrest.
Yes. And Gethsemane, of course. That garden at the foot of the Mount of Olives, where Jesus prayed and was betrayed. And finally, there's Calvary, or Golgotha, the site of Jesus' crucifixion. The traditional location is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But other sites have been proposed over the years.
So understanding the geography of Palestine, particularly Jerusalem, it's not just about knowing where things are. It's about grasping the context of the events that unfolded there, the lives of the people who live there, and the impact this land has had on history and faith.
It's like piecing together this giant puzzle, where each geographical feature, each city, each road, each building adds another layer of understanding to the story.
And it's a story that continues to resonate with us today, reminding us of the power of place, the complexities of human history, and the enduring legacy of faith.
It's amazing, isn't it? I feel like we've actually walked those dusty roads of ancient Palestine, you know, alongside Jesus, seeing the world through his eyes.
I know what you mean. It really gives you a much richer understanding of those gospel stories. It does. Thinking back on everything we've discussed, what stands out to you as particularly significant? What are some of those key takeaways?
Well, the sheer diversity of this land. I mean, we've gone from fertile coastal plains to rugged mountains, lush valleys to arid deserts, all within this relatively small area. And that diversity, it's not just geographical. It's cultural, political.
It really highlights how complex the world of Jesus was. That blend of Jewish, Roman, Hellenistic influences, all shaping the landscape, the people, the events.
Exactly. And this geographical understanding, I think it's so crucial for really grasping the context of the Gospels. When we read about Jesus traveling from Galilee to Jerusalem, we're not just talking about a change of scenery.
Right.
We're talking about crossing cultural and political boundaries.
Yeah.
Navigating a landscape fraught with tension, conflict.
It puts those journeys in a whole new light, not just a leisurely stroll.
Not at all.
I'm curious, now that you've got this mental map of ancient Palestine, is there a particular gospel story that stands out to you in a new way?
The story of the Good Samaritan comes to mind. That road from Jerusalem to Jericho, where that story takes place. It descends through the wilderness of Judea.
Right.
A desolate, dangerous area. It makes the priest and the Levite passing by the injured man, maybe fearing for their own safety. It makes it a lot more understandable.
Yeah. Knowing the setting really adds another layer to that story, doesn't it? The Samaritan's compassion shines even brighter against that backdrop of that harsh landscape.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder about those other journeys Jesus took. How did the geography shape his encounters, his teachings, his interactions with all those different communities?
It's a great question for all of us to ponder. Reread those familiar stories with fresh eyes. You know, imagine the landscape, the climate, those challenges those journeys would have presented.
I think that's a great way to engage with the Gospels.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating deep dive. Thanks for taking us on this journey through the land of Jesus.
My pleasure.
And for everyone listening, we hope you've gained a new perspective on the world of Jesus. And as you go about your day, we'll leave you with this question to ponder. Knowing what you now know about the geography of ancient Palestine, which Gospel story resonates with you in a new way?